So what is stopping us from dying young at a very old age currently?
You know, the history of our evolution has been that life expectancy through those 100,000 years, we argue, maybe more, the life expectancy was 20, 30 years old. And it's only in the last 150 years that something happened that we tripled this life expectancy. We have to remember that we never got to the aging that we get now. And what happened, we got to the age of 60 and we started having diseases that haven't been part of evolution. You know, we didn't die from Alzheimer and type 2 diabetes and cardiovascular disease and cancer. There are other things that killed us before. Our advance was in prevention. It's really prevention that was key. We kind of harnessed the agriculture, so there's food. We cleaned the water. We built sewers, vaccination, things like that. And that's how we got to where we got, which is now we get old and sick with several diseases, with several treatments, and we end up with bad quality of life. And this doesn't have to happen.
And you've studied people who've lived beyond 100, many people beyond 100. And what is the biggest secret they're hiding from the rest of us? Is it their genetics or is it their environment or their behaviors?
So for those people, okay, and not other, it's mainly genetics. They have genes that slows their aging. And we've discovered some of those genes and even two of them have been developed into drugs. In fact, those people are, when we ask about their habits, they are really not good habits. they're obese or overweight. They are smokers. They don't exercise. And it's very confusing. When I started writing those papers, people made jokes out of that. So the secret for longevity is to smoke and be obese. And no, for those people, because they had genes that slows their aging, it didn't matter. I have a woman who died at 110 and her secret was that she smoked for 95 years. Okay. of course, that's not what we think is going to help you to get to, you know, most probably you'll die young if you do that. But they were protected from the effect of the environment. In fact, it made our study more significant because they weren't doing something with the environment as a group. They didn't do something in the environment.
And what percentage roughly of the global population do you think has these longevity genes, and how would you know if you have them personally?
You know, it's rare because only one of 10,000 approximately, depends where, gets to the age of 100. So it's relatively rare. And some of the genes that we find are more common. Some are less common. Most of the genes we find are their frequency is less than 1%, of course, because we know it's rare. Yes, so it's genetics, but it's rare changes that happens in some people in their DNA that slows their aging.
And what have you found these genes to be involved with in terms of processes in the body, for example?
So I'll give you an example. It's really examples, but very important examples. Almost 60% of our centenarians have something that impacts their growth hormones. Okay, there's only one growth hormone, but there are actually many growth hormones. Okay, so I don't want people to be confused. So we found that 60% of the people have some changes in their DNA that affect their growth hormones. And those people are doing really well. How do we explain that? Well, we took data from the the UK Biobank, which is really a very good resource that advanced medicine a lot. And we looked at people, at 250,000 people who had a measure of one of the growth hormones. It's called IGF-1, doesn't really matter. And we looked at what happens if you have high IGF-1, if you have high levels of those growth hormones. And we found out that when you're young, it's always good for you. Mm-hmm. You're doing better. Okay, you're healthier, you get less diseases, you die less. But there is a switch. Over the age of 50, it switches. And this same high growth hormone that was good for you when you're young is against you when you're old. And so people with the same high hormone, they get more diseases and they get more mortality. So to understand that, and the reason I'm giving this example is because the point here is that when we started getting old, when we start to break down, we want to switch the energy from growth to protecting against the damage. It doesn't make sense to invest in growth at the same time.
And why does having a high amount of this growth hormone lead to more destruction in terms of our health? Does it lead to more cancers and things like that? What's the reason for that if it benefits us when we're young?
Well, again, it's a really a switch in energy, to put it mildly. But when we do the opposite, when we take this, when we take actually a drug that was developed to inhibit this growth hormone, actually for humans, it was used to treat cancer. It didn't succeed because cancers are smarter. And we gave this drug to old animals. They lived longer and they were much healthier. So this antagonism between the growth hormone and the aging is really important in what we're doing.
And what is one surprising fact about aging that most people don't know?
Well, I think, look, the one thing I think that people do realize is that we have a chronological age and a biological age, which are not the same. If you look at your parents and their friends, you see it. You might not see it with your friends now, but you see that your parents' friends or your grandparents' friends, some of them are aging really rapidly and some of them are aging slowly. So if that's the case, for me, when I noticed that, it was obvious that if that's the case, then aging is flexible. Okay. I think also people don't realize that it's this biology of aging. It's what you see. You know, you see now that you're young and I'm old. You just see that, right? But this biology also is the biology that drives diseases. And that goes back to the fact that there is a lot of preventive medicine that allows us to reach the age of 60. We have preventive medicine to stop your aging and to stop it before you get diseases. Okay? And this is kind of the revolution that we are leading now. We want to target your aging in order to prevent diseases. And we have success in that. We had success in models. We have success in humans. And we just need to implement it more widely than the few people who notice us and are doing that.
Okay. So you have some of the preventative measures. What's stopping it from becoming widespread and global? What are the hurdles that you have to overcome to make it a widespread thing?
So look, we have several stakeholders that need to hear about it. And one of them is the public, right? Pretty much the public, which is why I'm talking to you, okay? And why you're helping. The others are other scientists, because we're in silos, right? Even in the United States, you have the National Institute of Health, okay? And one of the institute is the National Institute of Aging. But the institutes are silos themselves. They're not talking with each other. And there's a lot of science that's going in everywhere. I'm also, I don't know the whole science on other institutes, but we kind of have to tell scientists, hey, something really important happened. And you have to listen to us because it implicates your disease. Okay, you have diseases that you're trying to treat. And we have the same diseases that we're trying to prevent. So we have to talk to them. We have to talk to politicians. And to politicians, we're saying something really interesting. If I go back to my study of 100 years old, it's not only that they live longer, they live healthier. They got diseases 30 years later. It's not only that they live longer and healthier, they had contraction of morbidity, they died. They 30% of them are not waking up in the morning. Okay, so so they die. We have diseases 5-8 years at the end of their life, and they don't. So we started talking about not only people who can live healthier for longer, but also are not a burden on our medical establishment. And we started talking about longevity dividend. Now, the CDC, the Center of Disease Control in the United States, have actually measured the medical cost in the last 2 years of life if you're dying at 100 years old, and it's third than if you're dying when you're 70. And this is the medical cost, but it's not the medical cost. There's actually a professor of economy in London Business School who's Andrew Scott, who said, guys, you don't know what you're talking about. You're saying that the patients are not in the hospital, but it's not only that. What are they doing? They are traveling, they are shopping, they're spending their money. So there's an economical value for this health that is like $36 trillion a year, which we can not afford not to do. So all of a sudden, the politicians are also listening to that. Now, they're the doctors that are the longevity doctors, whoever wants to help in that. And there are, of course, the biotechs and pharmaceuticals that have to help us in promote what we're doing. So those are the stakeholders. And with each one of them, we have to push this revolution in order to be successful. And as you know, any invention takes years until it popularizes. So I think we're in an inflection point, and we're doing well, but it'll take the time it'll take.
And how long, in your opinion, do you think it will take until we get to this revolution where it's widespread?
In the social media last week, there was a clip of Putin and Xi and the leaders that met in China, Modi that met in China. And they were walking together and there was a microphone and they were talking about longevity, which is kind of interesting. You know, they probably talked about longevity because they are personally concerned with longevity, but their people also need help. And Xi Jinping said, I think that in the next century, we'll be able to live to age 150.
Wow.
Okay, next century. So I'm giving it 50% chance, but really the time is important. But look, our lifespan as a human species is statistically 150. Many believe it's 120 based on other sources, but let's say that's the range, and we die on average, 50% of the die by the time we're 80 years old. So I think this 35, 40 years, we can realize right now, we can improve our health. We can improve our health significantly. We can prevent our aging significantly. So maybe that if we gain these 5 years, we can gain another 5 years and go slowly there. But I don't believe that I'll be 150. I actually don't believe that you'll be 150, but I might be wrong.
Okay. And
how old will you be in the next century?
I was born in 2004, so 96.
Yeah. Well, I'm not sure that you'll be able to be 150, but I think it'll be possible one day.
Well, hopefully, fingers crossed. And in terms of the people that make it past 100, a lot of it we've discussed is genetics, right? But what behaviors and mindsets did you find common amongst these people that live past 100, other than smoking?
So I told you, those people, I don't want to talk about that because you might say, oh, okay, the secret for longevity is to smoke. And I don't want it. But I'll tell you, we know that exercise, diet, sleep, and social connectivity have biological underpinning. And each one of them can be maximized, or I should say optimized. Okay, you can always do something. Okay, if you walked for 5,000 steps, you should go out and walk for 2,000 steps more before you go to bed. If you tried one diet and it doesn't help, you know, try Mediterranean diets, so try low carbohydrate, right? Try to be vegetarian or do intermittent fasting. Okay, so everyone has subtypes that are good for, it's personal, okay? Mm-hmm. It doesn't work the same for everyone. But there is a way to optimize your health, and this can come at any age.
Mm-hmm. And how long should you try these different exercise routines and diet plans before maybe switching to the next one if you think like it's not working?
This is not my expertise, and I'm not going to give you, you know, I try for myself, okay? I optimize the try for myself, and it's never working the same for my wife or for my friends, okay? So I think people, one of the reasons that people fail with diet is they try one diet and they fail and they say, you know, diet is not for me. But the truth is, so I'll give you an example. I think you know, there is an agreement, or people believe that vegetarian is good. Okay. If people in my age are deciding to be vegetarians, so they have less proteins, right? And they compensate with more carbohydrate, they will gain weight. And the weight gain for this is going to be much worse than if they stayed with whatever they did before. And that's the point, that diet is not good for everyone. It's the same for intermittent fasting, which I'm doing, but it's not everybody can do it or think that they cannot do it. And it's better working for men than women. And there's lots of chances. But the point is, you have to find what to do, and you have to be a little bit obsessive about it and give it a chance.
So it's kind of throwing a lot of different things at the wall and then seeing which sticks for you personally.
Right, right. You have to know that those are difficult things. Look, I'm a diabetologist, and I have patients at a clinic that I see, you know, on Thursday mornings if I'm in town. And I'm in this clinic for 30 years, and we used to say to diabetic patients, they have diabetes already, okay, which is a big, bad disease. And we tell them, look, you should lose weight and you should exercise. How many of them can do it? Maybe 3%, okay? Wow. Actually, less than 3%, wow. We know. Because it's hard for people, okay? They'll do better if we give them pills, but it's hard for people to do that because it's hard, okay? It's hard. And you have to decide to do that, and you have to be motivated to do that, and you have to have a plan where you find the best way to diet that makes sense for you. And you know, the diet is a bit about losing weight, and now we have tools for that. And then about maintaining weight and eating right. And those are things that are out there. Again, I'm not the scientist for that, okay?
Yeah.
But but this is what we know, and this is, and you have to find your own way in that. You know, sleep is, when you're young, the problem with sleep is mainly binge watching or you know, you're late at the pub and you have less sleep. So you have to actually monitor that. It, with old people, it's okay. They want to go to bed, they want to sleep, but they don't sleep so long. So, you know, so there are different problems in different ages.
Definitely, yeah. And in terms of intermittent fasting, from what you know about intermittent fasting, why does it work for you? Do you know any of the biology behind that?
So look, when I started in the biology of aging, and there were few of us, the experiment that worked really well is taking animals, mice, rats, others, dividing them to two groups. Half of them will eat whatever they want, and the other half will get 60% of them. It was called caloric restriction or dietary restriction. Those who were dietary restricted were healthier, and they lived 40% longer. So if mice or rat live about 2 years, they lived 3 years. Okay, this is really substantial. And we were trying through the years to understand how it works. People took it to mean that you should just eat less for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, right? But that's not what we've done. We brought the food to our animals in the morning. They were hungry, so they ate the food within an hour, and then they were fasting for 23 hours. So it's not only the caloric restriction, it's the fasting. In fact, when we give them food throughout the day, they don't live much longer. They're thin, but they don't live much longer. And this is where the intermittent fasting made sense, okay? And people who are doing intermittent fasting are usually losing weight without trying. They're either preserving muscle or even gaining muscle. I've gained muscle. There's lots of symptoms that happens as you grow out throughout the day. You lose focus or you're tired and this goes away. And a lot of people feel that way, not everyone, okay? And there are people who say, no, breakfast is my favorite meal. By the way, I love breakfast, so I have it for dinner sometimes, okay? it's not the rule. But it's something that is good for many people, even if not all. Hmm. So this is why I'm doing this. This is how it's helping me. And if it helps anyone, that's great.
Mm, definitely. From my personal experience, I've been having less carbs in the morning, and I've been waiting until maybe just for like brunch or just before lunch before I eat any food. And that's helped me maintain my mental focus and clarity. And it allows me to get the big task of the day done first. So I guess it is just trying things out and seeing what works for you personally, right?
Right.
Wait, hold that thought. I'm genuinely so grateful that you've stuck around with us to listen to these fascinating insights from the guest so far. If this episode has given you one piece of knowledge which has helped you understand yourself and the world a little bit better than before, the absolute best way to support us is to pay it forward and hit the share button right now. Don't let this knowledge stay hidden. Please send it to one person who will benefit from this episode. Thank you so much. Let's dive back into the rest of the episode.
And there is, you know, there's obviously a specific biology of what happens when we do it. I would say if we go back to evolution, scientists like to go back to evolution to understand why systems have developed. And there are many things that were different during evolution. One of them is how scarce food was. But the caveman woke up in the morning, start chasing the deer, got it in the evening when it got tired, brought it to barbecue. And so they probably were fasting a lot of time and eating once a day, and they didn't have carbohydrates.
Yeah.
Marie Antoinette and her cakes came later, right? And and so we were really, we're not built, I don't want to say not meant, but we're not built to eat all day, okay? Yeah. And we know now that if we eat all that all day, we accumulate garbage in our cells. And this garbage has a way to be cleared out, but the best way to clear it out is while you're fasting. So there is a lot of biology behind of why fasting is important. And by the way, people are doing fasting in different ways. Some people are doing 3 days fasting four times a year. You know, some people are fasting 24 hours once a week. I'm doing intermittent fasting every day because it's easy for me.
And in terms of carbohydrates, is the reason why I personally get this thing called a carb crash, where, you know, you get a spike in blood glucose and your brain becomes a bit foggy, is that because, like you said, in caveman times, we haven't adapted to have as much carbohydrates as we're having in the modern day? Is that our body becoming inflamed because of that, do you think?
Well, in part. Look, have you met? Is it true what you're saying? Did you take a 24-hour glucose monitoring and see that you have this up and that it's related to your brain? Or you're just thinking that way?
Yeah. Estimation. It's a guess.
Yeah. So I'm a diabetologist. And from time to time, I put, you know, every 2 months, 3 months, I'm putting a glucose monitoring and understanding what happens. And really the peaks are more related to the kind of food I have. For example, if I have rice, I really peak fast and high. But if I have potatoes or pasta, it's much lower. So this I could relate to actually what I'm feeling. And actually it's not that high, so it doesn't make that much of difference that I can notice. But people have beliefs like, I cannot skip breakfast. My glucose will be low in breakfast. Your glucose will be low only if you have a liver disease. Otherwise, your liver will produce as much glucose as it needs so that you don't get low glucose. But people have beliefs, but there's a biology too.
Definitely. And could we actually live without zero carbohydrates? Would we still be able to get glucose without carbohydrates in our diet?
So, look, first of all, if you have zero carbohydrate, let's say you need 3,000 calories, I'm just throwing it, for you to a day. And all of a sudden, you don't get, so you need the 3,000 calories. If you stop carbohydrates, that means that you have to supplement with proteins, okay? People will tell you that high protein is not good. Okay, so you'll do lipid. People will tell you fats are not good either, right? We're in a combination that's dangerous. I would tell you once, I don't think that you should be extreme. I think it's better to do fasting than to be extreme in what you're cutting. And if you're cutting, you're not doing it completely. So let's start with the fact that if I took my animal, right, and I would give the caloric restriction zero food, they'll die in a few days, right? There's the right amount of food to give, right? So it works like that. I would also say that, the protein issue, I think, was vilified. Again, what happened to us in evolution, the major change for us was that we became meat eaters, carnivores, okay? That was a big thing because that allowed our brain to grow, our muscle to grow. This was very determinant in our evolution. And to come and say now that you need zero of that makes no sense to me, okay? Mm-hmm. Yeah, maybe the kind of meat, maybe you do meat once a week and fish the other. You know, I agree with all that, but this idea that you have something and all of a sudden it has to be zero makes no sense to me. And therefore, I think some people who are very orthodox in what they're doing are actually putting their health in danger.
So it's better to have a mixture of carbohydrates, fats, and proteins rather than making it carnivore or vegetarian. It's too extreme for our bodies.
Right. And there are probably better choices within that we'll have to understand better. And I'm not going there because that's not my science.
Yeah. And how could you simply define, is it gerotherapeutics?
Yes.
How would you define that in simple terms for someone who doesn't understand it?
So gerotherapeutics is medicine that targets the biology of aging. Again, we want to target the biology of aging before you get diseases. It's never too late, by the way. So you can get disease and still will prevent the second disease. But this is what's gerotherapeutic. And the nice thing about gerotherapeutics, there are longevity biotechs who are developing gerotherapeutics, but there are several drugs that have been approved by the Food and Drug Administration here are being taken all over the world that if you give to animals, they live healthier and longer. If you give to humans for the disease for which they were developed, and you see what happens in clinical studies are placebo control. Okay, you take population, they don't know what they're taking. The investigators don't know what they're taking. It not only treats a disease, but it prevents a variety of other diseases.
Wow.
Not only that, you give them to a certain disease and it prevents overall mortality and not disease-specific mortality. So there are four drugs that actually have done that very convincingly, both in animals and in humans. And one of the things we're trying to do is popularize that and letting doctors know that they could. The nice thing with drugs that were approved, they have their safety. They pass their safety. And any doctor can repurpose them legally. Okay, you're not doing something wrong. So doctors have to know, hey, they're drugs. And if your guy is coming and say, doctor, I optimized everything. I need some help. There's help. Okay. Mm-hmm. Actually, the challenge is which of those drugs do I give this patient? Okay.
Yeah.
But there's help.
Mm. So is it, there's four, you mentioned four, is it a one size fits all for any kind of major disease? Or is it this, if you have cancer, you get this one, or if you're susceptible to cancer, you get this one, and if you're susceptible to Alzheimer's, you get the other one?
Well, those four drugs have shown effects on everything. Maybe cancer is questionable.
Yeah.
But they don't work exactly the same. Not every disease have been shown to be affected by every drug, but there's a commonality in the sense that they target the major hallmarks of aging, maybe by different ways, but that's why they're gerotherapeutics.
Hmm. And when would you start taking these drugs? What would be the situation? What would be the age and the time frame?
So that's a good question, because those drugs have been used or studied in people over the age of 50. Actually, the average age was sometimes 65 or 75. So it's definitely for people who start their breakdown. In fact, some of those drugs, for example, there's a very common drug, commonly used, cheap, that's called metformin. And metformin is not good for young people, okay? It decreases their growth hormones, okay? It decreases their testosterone. In males, it decreases testosterone. It prevents muscle growth if you're working on the gym in your muscles. So there's a reason not to take them. All those four drugs are really shown in older adults, and we don't know that it's good for younger adults. For younger adults, there's still the exercise and diet and sleep and social connectivity.
Mm. Yeah. And would it be taken as almost like a daily supplementation, even if you hadn't got any of these age-related diseases once you're past the age of, let's say, 50 or 60?
Right, right. Well, for example, GLP-1 agonists or the Ozempic or whatever they're called where you are, Mounjaro, they're different names. It's a weekly injection, okay, once a week. And actually in our Bible, as it's written, which is the New England Journal of Medicine, there's a company that now did a monthly injection. Okay. So, but the idea, if it's chronic, yes, it is. But I can see that some of those drugs will be rotated. Okay. For example, if you're obese, maybe the first drug that you do is those GLP-1 agonists. And when you lose weight, you go to metformin or SGLT2 inhibitors or so, you know, something else. So I think we don't know yet how to best practice that, but we're certainly able to try and see how it works on individuals.
Mm. And would metformin, for example, is that going to be an injection or is it in a tablet or pill form?
No, that's a pill, and you can take, wow, there's extended release, so you can take it once a day.
Mm. And will it increase our chances of getting to 115 as healthy individuals? Is that the goal for metformin?
Correct. It's about, everything is about extending our health span, okay? Now, look, it's the same mechanism. If we prevent diseases, you'll also live longer, right? It's kind of the same mechanisms, but our goal is for people to be healthier for longer, to spend their time, their life in health and not in disease. And this is kind of the revolution that we're proposing.
Hmm. And does it enhance anything? Because you said it can decrease your muscles if you're before the age of 50. It obviously prevents these diseases, but is there any other kind of side effects that are benefits of taking something, for example, metformin?
So look, every drug ever developed saved 100 and killed 3. Mm. And I'm just using this ratio. It might change between drugs. So we have to get better at choosing the 100 and better at avoiding those 3. Okay? And it's easier when we have FDA-approved drugs that have been in use for so long and you accumulate a lot of data, you can do it better. But at the end, it's individual. So is metformin for everyone? No. Between 3 and 6% will have diarrhea that will not resolve in a week. And that means that they should not take metformin. Okay? And we understand the biology of why it happens. As I said, young people shouldn't. If you take metformin and you feel that you're losing muscle, then you should stop metformin. You know, I can go on every drug, and every drug, just like we talked about food and diets, not every drug is good for everyone. But those four drugs have shown on population, you know, on studies that had 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 patients, to decrease within 3 years several diseases and mortality by 30-40%. So they're powerful drugs if you can tolerate them.
That's just incredible. It's just so exciting. And I've heard a lot about Ozempic and drugs like that, but I'd never heard of metformin. Is that because it's not as widely available yet?
No, it's the opposite. Metformin is a drug that it's an extract of the French lilac and was used in Europe between 1920 to 1950 as kind of a gerotherapeutic against osteoarthritis, against the flu. And when people use this drug, they notice that people who had diabetes, it lowered their glucose. So it became a diabetic drug. There's probably not any drug in the market that has been used chronically as extensively as metformin. There are billions and billions of years of use because again, diabetic patient takes it for life, right? They have diabetes and they take this drug for life. So we know a lot about metformin. And another thing about metformin is generic and it's cheap. It's the cheapest drug in the formulary of the UK and the US. Wow. and things. So it'll be no-brainer for healthcare providers to say, we have to push metformin and try to take metformin, and they'll get a huge buck for their money.
That begs the question. And I know we were talking about the pillars and the hallmarks earlier in terms of you need to convince all these people. But if it's been used for such a long time and it's so cheap, why am I not hearing my uncle or my granddad using it? Why is it not being used by everyone to stop the aging process, right?
Because it has to be prescribed, okay? And your doctors, the doctors don't know that we can target aging, okay? It's not the main, you know, it's one of our challenges.
Mm. And why don't the doctors know about this? They're just not taught about it when they're, you know, being educated to become doctors?
Right, because it's a new science. A new science trickles slowly.
Mm.
I would say that there are tens of millions of people in the world that are taking metformin for aging. So it's not that people who are interested, no. Doctors who are interested, no. Okay? But the public might know after they hear this podcast.
Mm. Hopefully, that's the goal, isn't it? And if you want to take metformin and your doctor's not letting you take it and you can't find any doctors near you who are prescribing metformin, what do you do in that situation, do you think?
So I can, so I don't prescribe metformin because I'm involved in that and I'm talking with the FDA about that. So I don't want to prescribe metformin. But my friends who come and say, how do I get metformin? I said to them, okay, you write to your doctor. What do you think about those articles? And I give them two papers to attach. I'd like to take metformin. Now, what will happen is one of two things. The doctor will say, I don't have time for this bullshit, but you know, metformin has been around. It's a good drug. Let's just, my patient wanted it. Let's just prescribe. Or they'll read about it and then call me and said, how come we didn't know about it? Not that you cannot find, but listen, you know, medical literature, there's nobody can keep up with medical literature. Yeah. You have to have the revolution in order for people to start switching. People have to start talking about it. People have to start demanding from the doctor's help.
Mm. So it's almost like a marketing problem in a way. It's just not getting...
Right. It's in part marketing problem. You're right.
Mm. And if we can go back a bit, what inspired you to get into this field of research? Were there any experiences in your childhood that made you so interested in this interesting field?
Well, when I was a child and I saw my grandfather, who died at age 68 and looked pretty old, I thought, I mean, it's incredible what he did, what he told me he did when he was young and how he looks like made almost no sense, right? This biology of aging. Most of my friends said about their grandparents, I don't know what happened to them. You know, I don't know where they came from. I saw where I'm going. And a child, you don't see. Your grandparents are your grandparents. They're supposed to look like that, right? In medical school, I learned that you can take a blood test and know your sugar level, know your cholesterol level. You have a test for blood pressure, but if we put 100 people out there, I wouldn't know who has high cholesterol or high glucose, but I would know who's young and who's old. That was always the biggest question for me. What is this aging? When I was in my residency, I had an attending. Whenever I presented the case, he stopped me. I said, this is a 75-year-old woman. He said, does she look older or younger than her age? And I said, what does it matter? And then you learn it matters. This 75-year-old woman, if she looks older than her age, she has every organ fucked up. And there, you know, you have to think how to deal with her. But there could be a 90 years old that, you know, he's out of here in a second because he's really healthy. So the biological and chronological age really mattered. And that's what gave me the hope that we can do something about it. And now we went from hope to promise, and now we're realizing the promise. So it's very exciting.
Very, very exciting indeed. And what are three actions viewers should take right now to increase their health and lifespan, even if they don't have the genes that we were discussing at the start of the podcast?
You're too young for me to answer that. You're too young. No, that I answered. I think I wouldn't recommend any gerotherapeutics, although I think in the future, again, let's look 50 before the next century. Okay, let's look at 50 years from now. People your age will get a treatment every few months or a year or years to kind of reverse their aging. Okay, we're kind of doing it now in organs. We're doing it. We're starting doing that. This will stunt. It's the Peter Pan scenario. Okay, never grow old. It'll stunt your aging, and you'll probably be able to live much longer. But this therapy is not available, and if it was, it wouldn't be safe for you. So for now, what you need to know, until we know differently, is you just have to optimize your health with your environment. And once you're 50, I think everybody should start considering what they can do more.
Definitely, definitely. And what are three things we should purposely avoid if we want to increase our health span and our lifespan?
Well, I think people know that, you know, they shouldn't smoke, right? They shouldn't be obese. They should treat their hypertension. They should do the cancer prevention. I mean, I think this, the medical establishment kind of knows. Are they practicing it well? I'm not sure. Not everywhere. At the UK, for me, the index of success is life expectancy at the country, or maybe even at the city or the county or the state that you're in. Life expectancy in the UK is, I think, top 10 in the world. And the United States is 45.
Wow.
So yes. And if you want to calculate how much money per longevity, it's ridiculous. It's the last in the world, okay?
Wow.
Now the point is that I live in New York City, and the best hospital in the world are a mile away in each side of where I am. And my chances of getting good therapy are very different than people in the United States who are living in a village in the South, okay? Or something like that. And so some people get good medical care and not. The UK, I know that you're complaining about your health system, but your health system is much better than the United States, okay? I'm at Einstein. Relativity is actually very important for me, okay? You're doing much better than the average population in the United States. There's always room for improvement. But that's it. It's country specific.
And why is the US so low if they're such a developed country economically?
Because medical therapy doesn't, and prevention therapy doesn't get to large part of the population.
Is it just a lack of access then?
That too. It's less of access, less of education, lack of doctors. There's lots of issues. But I'll tell you, in every city in the world, the rich live 20, 30 years longer than the poor.
Wow.
And sometimes you can do it geographically. You know, the south part of the city is the poor city, and you can do it. And there's data available in every place in the UK, almost every place in the world. And this is really important to note, because the intervention that we have now are maybe more relevant to the poor. Than to the rich, who are anyhow doing better in optimizing their health better and have access to medical therapy and to prevention. But by the way, you know, part of it, you know, There are two stages for longevity. First of all, you have to get there, okay? Don't die in the middle. Don't cross the road do cancer prevention, you know, treat your hypertension, treat your cholesterol, and then we can actually do something in addition.
Definitely. And if the rich live 20 to 30 years longer than the poor, using that logic, surely would one good action to take if you're below 50 would be to increase your personal wealth, do you think?
Wealth is always an issue, but look, that's why I chose the poor as an example of who needs to get therapy first. And I would say that metformin, which is the cheapest drug in the formulary, should be a major tool for the poor first.
Yeah.
Okay. It will prevent variety of diseases and it will improve their health. Much cheaper than do what we actually should do, which is making exercise, you know, gyms available, fitness centers, or allowing them to buy treadmill or bring fresh vegetables and fruits to their area, convince them that fish is healthy. They don't like fish. Okay. So there's a lot of challenges to improve the health span of the poor. And therefore, I think medicine should be considered even more in the poor than in the rich.
Yeah. And like you said at the start of the interview, if people have a longer health span, they end up spending more money anyway and contributing more to the economy. So it would actually be not a zero-sum game. It would be a positive sum, right?
Right.
Yeah. And right. Some say aging is inevitable and we should accept it. What would you say to skeptics who think anti-aging research is just vanity?
I think death is inevitable. Aging the way it is now is, it shouldn't happen this way. We have tools to increase your health span and lifespan, and it's not going to destroy our economy. So it's good for the person and it's good for the country. And this has to come rapidly right now to a pharmacy near you.
Definitely. And do you think we have to solve the aging problem before we can venture out to Mars and space?
Exactly. Look, aging, it's not only about old people. People who have cancer are aging rapidly. People who have HIV are aging rapidly. Disabled people, the poor, people with Down syndrome are aging rapidly. Aging research is important for fruits and vegetables because we want to increase their shelf life. And we're not going to get to Mars if we didn't stop aging. Absolutely. And we're never coming back.
Yeah. And as a final question, if you could give your 20-year-old one piece of advice, what would it be?
20 years old, get a life. Look, from an aging perspective, you know, I think what 20 years... I was going to answer something, but now I changed my mind. Okay, so let me find the words. But I think it's true for everyone. If you understand this concept that you can improve your health at any age, one of the things you should do is use technology. Okay, yes. You have Fitbit, you have Oura Rings. Become a little bit obsessive about your health, so that you can manage it better. You know, some of those things will tell you that you contracted virus and you're going to be sick tomorrow. Okay,
wow.
They see the skin temperature, the change in your pulse, and they will tell you you're getting sick. They will tell you how many steps you did or how much exercise or how many times you increase your pulse. They'll tell you how well did you sleep, how many hours did you sleep, and what was your REM sleep. They will tell you when it's time to do physical. They will tell you if your doctor should prescribe a cholesterol pill. You can manage yourself very nice with some instruments. And I think what's being developed now are applications that will take all those things and put them at once. And you'll have an application that you'll have to check once a day and decide what you need to do. Mm-hmm. And if you become this, with this little bit obsessive, people become obsessive in many ways. They can wear 100 things and check that all the time, right? But this is part of a obsessive compulsive behavior. But everybody who needs to take care of his health has to be a little bit obsessive. Yep. People do it when they have disease. If you have diabetes, you have to be obsessive because you have to treat it. So what I'm saying is to take care of your healthcare, start getting information. And this information will lead to better decisions and extended health span.
Mm, yeah. Peter Drucker said, what gets measured gets managed. And I guess if you're using one of these tools to measure your health, you're going to be way ahead of the curve in terms of if you're dealing with stress, if you're dealing with sleep, and you're definitely convincing me to get a Whoop strap on Oura Ring for sure.
Terrific.
Dr. Nir Barzilay, ladies and gentlemen, Nir, I really, really appreciate your time. Really appreciated this. And thank you for enlightening myself and the audience on this upcoming revolution. And where can people go if they want to find your work?
They can find my name. So I think a lot of information will be found. I'm the president of the Academy for Health and Lifespan Research, AHLR. And you can find a lot of information there and how to get to me. And listen, thank you. As I said, this is part of our effort to educate the public. And I know your listeners are young, but they'll get there too. So we'll see you younger as time goes by.
Yes, fingers crossed. Thank you so much. I'll leave the links to all your work and what you're doing in the show notes below for you as well, so the audience can check it out right now. Everyone go do that. If you've made it this far, you're likely not just a listener, you're ready to be the host. You felt that sense of intimacy and connection with our guest today, and you would like to get the same on your own show and start your own dream show. But you're worried about landing dream guests and all the complications and the mess that is often spoken about when starting your own podcast from scratch. You think starting a podcast requires a huge budget and a whole team, right? That is absolute nonsense. My Pro Remote Podcast Blueprint is the ultimate key to skipping the outdated advice and building a high quality, high impact show, even for under $100. It provides the proven strategies and AI templates that I use to this day that you will be able to use to reclaim your time and creative control. And this is a strictly limited opportunity. Don't dilly-dally because there's limited spaces. We've already got one student, Rob, who's joined. That means there's only a couple more spaces to get the Pro Remote Podcast Blueprint course half price. And you need to act very, very fast because this is a limited offer and you're very, very early. So if you want to get the early bird discount like Rob has and get the results by watching the course that goes through the exact step-by-step blueprint that I use to this day to create these episodes that you've just watched and get the success and become Europe's fastest growing under 21 podcaster, and also join live weekly calls with me and use the AI templates and email templates that I use every single day to get the results and just get all my secrets without getting any of the mistakes and failures that I've made, then top link in the description is for you. And if you're ready to launch your own show and get personalized one-to-one help from me and copy my blueprint, which no other podcaster has shared, then I'll see you there. I'm rooting for you. Goodbye. Hope you enjoyed the episode too.